Good morning, everyone. For this talk, I'd like to encourage folks to sit in the posture of maintaining Zazen, and then we will sit comfortably for the Dharma dialogue that follows. Zazen is not just a practice of mind. It is not just a thing that you do with your mind, even if that thing that you're doing is attending or concentrating. Zazen includes the mind. And it's very easy for us in our culture to identify ourselves with the goings-on of our mind. Zazen is not limited to that. Zazen is also done with breath and body. And it's not that we apply the mind to the breath. It is not that we focus specifically on bodily sensations, but sitting in presence to breath, sitting in presence to mind, sitting in presence to body. Body, breath, and mind harmoniously zazening. And it's even more than body, breath, and mind. This one thing that is body, breath, and mind. It is actually this one thing that is body, breath, mind, and universe. The entire universe is the true human body. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. When we begin exploring Zazen, it is the tradition of our school to encourage people to count the breath. There are two ways of doing this. One, breathing in, counting silently. One, breathing out, counting silently. Two, in three, so on up to 10. Doesn't matter if you get to 10. Doesn't actually matter if you get to 2. The other way is breathing in, counting 1, breathing out, silently, breathing in, counting 2, so on up to 10. Doesn't matter if you get to 10. Doesn't matter if you get to 2. The power of this practice is it, when you're doing breath counting practice, is beginning to familiarize yourself with the capacity for choiceful attention. Beginning to familiarize yourself with this large, vast category of things that are mental formations, arising phenomena. And the value of this practice is not in the staying, but in the noticing that we're engaged in any other activity other than just touching body, breath, and mind, and counting. And we see that that's happened. We desist, we back off from adding more fuel onto that fire of doing. And then we come back to the arbitrary anchor of the breath and one. And this begins to cultivate a capacity in our off-the-cushion lives to choicefully engage with what arises. When fear arises, we don't have to hide out of fear. When sadness and grief arise, we don't have to shrink from them or cover it over with anger. When anger arises, we don't need to react from that place. We can be choicefully present and taking action in alignment with our highest values. Zen holds up some suggestions for these in the form of the Bodhisattva vows and the 16 precepts. So we begin with the scaffolding of counting. Then we begin to dismantle that scaffolding. And there's no, I'm going to talk about several different modes of practice in this talk. It is not the case that one is more advanced than another. They are different and differently useful at different times. So, beginning to dismantle the scaffolding of the counting, we practice just with following the breath. Just bringing our full attention to the physicality of breathing. When we notice that we are doing another thing with our mind other than just being with the physicality of breathing, we desist from adding fuel onto that fire of doing. And then in so doing, we unhook. And then we bring our attention back to just the physicality of body breathing. We're not trying to breathe some way and not some other way. We're not trying to have slow breaths or long breaths. Although we are encouraged to breathe from to do diaphragmatic breathing, which is where with each breath the belly comes in and out. This is what happens when we just release some of the tension in our upper chest and let the breath fall to the level of the diaphragm. And we breathe from the hara, is the Zen word for it, which is around three fingers below the navel. This is where we hold our attention in breath practice. And sometimes in breath practice, you know, so we normally tend to locate ourselves in the center of our head. And we breathe from there in a certain way. And one thing that can be helpful is to imagine taking that single point of awareness that seems to be in the center of the head and physically in your mind pulling it down to the hara. And then breathing into it, breathing from there. And then when the mind moves, it pops right back up. And when we see that that's happened, we physically bring it down and again continue breathing from the hara. Another way that this has been described is breathing in, we imagine a plunger descending on our head, a piston pushing gently down. And breathing out, the plunger doesn't go up. Breathing in, coming down. Breathing out, not going up. These are tools These are, in a certain way, in the very best sense, contrivances. They are things that we do they are scaffolding forms for this practice of just being the breath, just following the breath. And in the forms of breath practice, whether it's counting the breath or following the breath, in a certain sense, we are practicing a preference. We are practicing a preference for breath as the object of mind. Whenever we notice that the object of mind is not breath, we replace it with breath. And this is a powerful, useful, transcendent, liberating practice. And all of those tools, all of those scaffolding elements, whether it's counting or holding the hara, or depressing the piston, or replacing the object of mind, all of those are fairly substantive doings, strivings, intendings. And and at a certain point, those may start to feel a little much, a little controlled, contrived, a little unnecessary. And when we do those things, when we enact those kind of intentions, which are wholesome and worth doing, there's another category of mental formation that can arise, which is a volitional formation, intending, striving. One form that this takes is fixing, or and one kind of confused form that this can take is imagining that when the object of mind is not breath, then what has arisen is problematic, and so we will apply the antidote of breath to fix that. That is not what we're doing. But there is a practice at a certain point that we move into, which is called Shikantaza. Shikantaza, as we read this morning, relies on no contrivance. Shikantaza does not prefer, Shikantaza means just sitting. Shikantaza does not prefer some object of mind to some other object of mind. And I want to be clear about Shikantaza. Shikantaza is still done with this one thing that is body, breath, mind, and universe. The entire universe is the true human breath. The entire universe is the Dharma body of the self. Shikantaza, although it doesn't prefer some object of mind to some other object of mind, and it's is still done with breath, body, and universe. And even within Shikantaza, there are levels of doings, subtle strivings. And beginning Shikantaza, we may use the scaffolding of subtle strivings. At some point, we may use less. At some point, we may use no scaffoldings. And even within Shikantaza, it isn't the case that some version is more advanced than another version. It isn't the case that no scaffolding has an inherent quality that is better than a little scaffolding. Some of those one such scaffolding in Shikantaza is this active desisting, this active discerning when mind is engaged in the fires of doing and desisting from fueling that fire. This is an active thing which we do. What's different in Shikantaza versus breath practice is that we then do not engage in the doing which is bringing the attention to the breath specifically. We just desist and carry on just sitting with breath, body, mind, and the true Dharma body of the self. Another piece of scaffolding within Shikantaza is this little teeny, teeny, teeny inward gesture that is turning toward what is, turning toward what is arising right here, turning towards what the universe is doing right here in this part that is breath, body, and mind. This little teeny turning towards, this intimate turning towards. It's so small as to be almost nothing, but it is not nothing. Shikantaza is not a practice of just watching thoughts. It is not a practice of just spacing out. It is an active practice of intimately turning towards. Another way that I express this is in the language of receiving. We are receiving what is. We are using breath, body, and mind to receive the entirety of breath, body, and mind. And again, this is not something accomplished just with the mind. It is only ever accomplished with breath, body, and mind, and universe together. We also can call this entrusting. Entrusting breath, body, and mind to breath, body, and mind. Entrusting breath, body, mind, and universe of this moment to breath, body, mind, and universe of this moment. Another piece of the scaffolding of Shikantaza comes from the poem of the second ancestor Tsingtsan, who is not Sungtsan. In a poem called "Affirming Faith and Mind," which can also be translated as "The Heart of True and Trusting," and that has the line, "Immediately affirm, not to." And whatever arises, whatever story of mind gone away, mind come back, focused, not focused, confused, not confused, immediately affirming, not to. Self, other, body, breath, and mind, universe, immediately affirming, not to. All of these are elements of the scaffolding of Shikantaza. And Shikantaza. I also recently learned that the just of just sitting can also be heard as a kind of get on with sitting, which is Dogen's message continually. Shikantaza is not in the sphere of the doable by your small mind and small intentions alone, but get on with it. It is not in a category of things that you can actually even be sure you are doing, because this being sure is actually just another arising. And we receive all arisings into the same one category. And that category is stuff that arises. There's not good stuff and bad stuff. There's not the stuff we're trying to have and the stuff we're not trying to have. There's not breath and body and sensations and traffic. It's all stuff that arises. And Shikantaza is the active receiving of all of that stuff into the same one category. Also, receiving is just another category of stuff that arises. And receiving that. Receiving everything that arises into the same one category is another form of immediately affirming not to. And one form that Shikantaza takes is letting go even of the contrivances of receiving, even the contrivances, the scaffolding of turning toward, even the scaffolding of immediately affirming not to. And when we practice, by the way, when we practice immediately affirming not to, this is not necessarily a verbal thing. It is affirming with body, breath, and mind, and universe not to. So, but there comes, one form of Shikantaza is letting go of all of these. This is, and again, this is not a better, more advanced, this is stepping off the cliff of the known, stepping off the cliff of the doable, stepping off the cliff of all certainties, and entering the free fall of just sitting with this one thing that is body, breath, and mind and universe. This is not accomplished by you. It is only accomplished by the entirety of the universe, inclusive of you. And we don't get to be certain we are doing it, because certainty is just an arising. We also have to be willing to part with the certainty that we aren't doing it. Because that too is just an arising. Practicing in this free fall of Shikantaza lets us engage with the very, very subtle mental formations. Subtle mental formations of willing, intending, striving, knowing, and meeting them not as a special kind of thing with a special ontological status of truly existing and not needing examination, but meeting them all equally. In this free fall of Shikantaza, so often we grab on to some form of certainty to try to stop our fall. Wile E. Coyote grabbing onto a branch off the cliff he's just fallen. And then that branch breaks. Seeing this impulse to grab without buying into the story of grabbing. When we're in practicing in this free fall, we are practicing with comfortableness. We are practicing being comfortable with not knowing, comfortable with uncertainty, comfortable with discomfort, comfortable with raging mind. And this comfortable isn't a state of mind that feels some way and not some other way. Sitting in this free fall, vast not knowing of the entire one bright pearl of the universe, sitting in this vast not knowing of the single geometrical dimensionless point of the universe, sitting in the endarkenment of the universe beyond all seeing, sitting with the endarkenment, which is another synonym for enlightenment, sitting with the endarkenment that is not limited to any form of experience, any set of circumstances arising, but can meet continuously, seamlessly, all of them. So, at this point, please do sit comfortably, and be invited to direct your eyes as you see fit, and come forth in Dharma dialogue. Questions or comments or observations or resonances. I'm also aware that there are many people who are here for a first or second or third time. And so also please be invited to use this this Dharma dialogue to ask about any piece of practice that you've encountered here, or any other question.
So first, thank you so much for that talk, Josh, that just, you know, had so much that we want to know about Zazen. And I just wanted to say that one thing that came up for me is then also the, you know, the getting up from the cushion. And I was thinking about that with the breath, because my Zen life began at a place that really emphasized the breath practice and lots and lots of long periods of breath practice. And after a while, you know, that just becomes a lot of the time how you breathe. You know, it's not just on the cushion. And I found that very helpful in my life in various ways. And when I came here and learned to do Shikantaza, you know, that started to become more and more a way of just engaging with the world. So, and yet, there's never a leaving of the cushion behind, you know, for me. There's never a time when I don't really need to keep returning to the sitting practice, no matter how much it starts to bleed into my what I think of as my ordinary life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is important. So it's not so there is a gradual transformation that takes place in our hearts and in our lives as a result of practice. And it isn't the case that we do Zazen to make it happen. But in doing Zazen just as Zazen, then our relation to our hearts, our minds, our lives, our suffering, our other's suffering, the unsatisfactoriness that is a mark of all things, this starts to change and we start to be able to meet this in a different way.
There was a very beautiful description of practice that you gave. And I found myself wishing, yeah, that's the orientation I wish I gave this morning. Because mine was lame compared to that. But it really struck me, it really resonated with me when you spoke about not knowing. At least for me, like everybody else, you know, started off counting breaths, and then it was following breaths, and then it was shikantaza, and never being certain that I don't know if I'm doing this right. I don't know it, and just obsessing on, am I doing it right? Am I getting it? Am I not getting it? And you know, teachers asking like, well, my practice is shikantaza. How's that going? I don't know. Oh, what a tremendous gift. Good for you. just aggravation causing myself not being able to just sit with not knowing how I'm doing. And just giving up and just, you know, tearing my hair out. And
is that what happened?
But yeah, for me, you know, things started to open up when I sort of relinquished this, you know, having to know, and you know, wanting that certainty, and just, no, I'm just going to sit and see what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's what opened up things for me.
Thank you, Stephen. Beautifully expressed. And This is also part of the power and value of coming to Dokusan frequently when engaged in the practice of shikantaza. Because one of the things that happens for beings who have the, let's call it a handicap or deficiency of being human, is that if we're not continually coming to shikantaza, to Dokusan while we're practicing shikantaza, it can subtly morph into a secret practice. This practice that we're really doing without examining it, while saying, oh yeah, I'm doing shikantaza, but really we're trying to feel spacious, but really we're trying to be calm, but really we're trying to fix mental formations. And coming to Dokusan helps us together bring those things into the light and find these additional levels of previously unexamined certainties, knowings that we have exempted from meeting as just arisings and taking as actual truths of the universe. And this helps us settle more and more into the unsettling free fall of not knowing that Stephen's pointing to.
Rex?
Really enjoyed your talk. I, relatively new to Zen practice, I count my breath. And I'm wondering when or why might it be appropriate for someone introduced to Zazen through counting one's breath to transition or experiment with these other forms of Zazen?
Yeah, so that is a tremendously important question. And part of what you're pointing to, so I just spoke about why it's important to come to see a teacher frequently when doing Shikantaza, and that question is why it's important to come to see a teacher frequently when counting the breath or following the breath or doing any kind of breath practice. There isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of answer, but it's something that is discerned in the process of Dzogchen. So bring that question to Dzogchen and examine it. Carol.
Just to add on to that, is that okay? it's not really a question of advancing from counting your breath to following it to Shikantaza. I, at least in my experience, that sometimes I'm back counting my breath. So,
mm-hmm. And with body, breath, and mind, while counting the breath, immediately affirm not to. Yeah, it is not a matter of advancing from a chump practice to the cool kids practice. They are differing skillful means at differing times. And don't imagine that that being said, don't buy into the story of treating disorders of mind with practices. Don't fall into the story of fixing. Don't fall into the story. Because it, especially with this intimate turning towards, there's a way that counting the breath can get subverted into a pushing away, into a kind of spiritual bypass, rather than being with the difficult business of being a human in the world and the suffering of being. We may count the breath to keep all of that out. And so don't imagine that if what's arising for you is vivid suffering, that that should be treated with counting rather than just sitting. And this is a discernment that you should do with a teacher in Dzogchen. This is exactly what to bring into Dzogchen. And so all of these practices are a kind of dynamic engagement, and kind of there is a kind of reattunement. There is a thing that can happen in Dzogchen. So then this is. You don't have to come to Dzogchen with a question, although please be encouraged to bring any question you have. But also, one way to engage these meetings is to say, here's what's arising for me in my zazen, and here's how I'm meeting it. And then the teacher can respond. And this respond is not a correction or a criticism. It is just a form of dynamic engagement.
Josh, thank you for a wonderful talk, which, you know, as I was listening to it, I was putting it together in my mind as a kind of progression. But then I think that it's a kind of a talk that comes back and bites its tail. There isn't a progression in zazen. And I was also reminded of the first time that I came here, and you gave me a kind of abbreviated version of this talk, and I said, I'm not sure I can do that. And you said, well, that's what we do here. And the difficulty was with letting go of some kind of effort to create a special state. It's just what you're saying about treating. And even though I know that, that that's an essential characteristic of Zazen, that we don't do that. What my Zazen frequently consists of now is the exploration of the habit of doing that,
right,
which has many subtle forms. It's just going to be an endless practice,
right,
of looking at that.
And exploration of the habit of doing that. So the habit energy arises. We see arise, efforting, and just receiving even that efforting as the exact same another expression of things we receive into the same one category. But seeing efforting arising as efforting is different than actually buying into the story of striving and trying to do that thing. And the stuff that arises for us is all just karmic conditioning. It's all just habit energy. It all arises from the causes and conditions that have brought us to here. And it doesn't matter which causes and conditions we're meeting, but meeting them. Libby.
I've been thinking during your talk of previous talks where you've sort of addressed things that are troubling us all right now, and you've spoken about how we need to bring things such as fear into our zazen as a friend and to sit with fear. And what I was thinking about today as you were talking was I started coming in September thinking it would be really, really hard to sit for 25 minutes and count my breath, and they have discovered it's way more hard than that. And trying to make friends with fear is really, really, really hard. And my question is, what do I do with fear when it comes up in other parts of the day when I'm not doing that? And I feel like what's happened is that I've opened myself up to fear more.
Right.
And now I'm terrified. Mm. And I'm wondering, like, maybe I shouldn't have, like, you know, tried to do what Josh was telling me to do. Maybe I should just have fear out.
Right. Yeah. So that's not an option. That's not on the table as a choice we can have. We can push fear away, but it doesn't actually go away. And I want to differentiate. You said bringing fear in. It isn't that we go out and find some fear and bring it in. But when fear is present, we let that be included. And for me, I noticed that a certain point in my practice, in my life, I was feeling more anxiety, more fear, more of the time. What was actually going on there was a result of this choiceful engagement with life. Because what I used to do was when there was fear or anxiety, I would push it away, I would do some other thing. If going toward that meant I would be afraid, I don't go toward that, I go toward this. But through the power of, through the practice of Zazen, I started recognizing that I had more important goals in my life, higher values than simply avoiding fear, and acting in the service of those higher values, such as compassion, kindness, saving all beings, I might opt toward fear. And what we're doing in in Zazen when we are meeting fear is we are beginning to diminish our fear of fear. And then we can meet fear as just fear. So, I want to be clear, I don't think there is a path through life that, especially now, that these are, in a certain sense, quite terrifying times. And so this practice of befriending fear, being unafraid of fear, is particularly important.
Also, I mean, that's lovely, right? But so this trying to avoid fear and hold it at bay, my sense is that while that may feel more comfortable than experiencing, you know, the full effects of the fear, that for me what it seems to actually do is just hold it at a distance and make fear become a part of my entire life, right? I know I don't want to think about it, but I know that it's just, you know, below the level of consciousness there, right? And it's omnipresent then, right? There's no way of escaping it because I'm afraid of this actually feeling, and I become so I have to hold it there, right? And so I'm expending all this energy to manage my fear, to hold it down to a manageable level, and that by, you know, opening ourselves up to it, you know, and allowing ourselves to feel it, there's the possibility that Josh was talking about here of you know, no longer being so afraid of fear and just, you know, letting it move through me and then on to the next thing. And I think that's so important that this need to hold it down actually makes it present throughout my life.
Sure.
Just on this thing that you're talking about, what I found, I guess a metaphor for how it feels to me is that if I've got my kind of my small self, I have a small container for the fear, and the fear can become overwhelming and overflow very quickly. And there's something about Zazen practice that somehow makes a larger space, a larger container in which that fear can just be fear in a larger area.
Right. Well expressed.
I think, like, especially with fear, you know, it's there for a reason. Like, it's sort of an evolutionary drive. Your fear is telling you something, and although it's distorted somewhat by, you know, the causes and conditions of not being on the savannah anymore, there is a real message there.
Right. There is sometimes. And everybody should see the very important heavy Dharma movie, which is the animated thing from Pixar, Inside Out, which really does a great job of portraying that. Everybody should really see that. It's a great movie. And so fear has served a purpose. Fear has especially served an evolutionary purpose. Living without fear is entirely a path to a very short life. And fear takes that's fear's job, to arise and say, "Watch out for that, that's going to get you, be aware." And it takes that job a little too seriously, right? So it isn't always giving you great information. And so being able to appreciate fear for doing its job, thank you, buddy, thanks for looking out for me, without necessarily acting, cowering each time fear says there might be something that you should cower from. So one last comment, we'll go with Cheryl.
You know, I was thinking about, you know, looking like your comment about turning toward, you know, so when we're talking about fear, I was thinking fear in some ways is a little bit like a bodily pain. Like if I'm starting to get a pain in my knee when I'm sitting zazen, turning toward that pain and noticing it, but it changes.
Right.
It doesn't stay the same, you know. Right. And so noticing the changes is very helpful.
Right.
Like, well, is this pain I'm feeling just there because I expect to feel it, or is it really still there? And it's a very subtle thing.
Right. That's super important. Super, super important. And I'm so glad you brought that up. This is why we sit still in zazen. We don't sit still to be samurai tough guys. We sit still to give ourselves the opportunity. So normally what happens is we have a pain in our knee or a scratch on our nose, and our mind, perhaps our fear-driven mind, says, you have to fix that. You have to fix that now. You got to make that go away. That's a problem. You might die. You might become paralyzed. And if we just shift every time our mind says, you better shift because you might die, right? We never have the opportunity to see that's actually not true. And that's actually just our little fear guy saying, hey, you got to do this thing, man. And so we sit still. And part of the opportunity, you should sit still in the posture that is most suitable to you. There is no value to sitting in a particularly pain-inducing posture. Because it isn't the case that we have to go courting pain and discomfort. We don't need to manufacture that. Life actually will bring you plenty of that to work with. So sit in whatever posture you can maintain in most stillness. And then that gives us the opportunity to work with pain. And what happens when we do that is we start to see that pain arising is, in a certain sense, fundamentally neutral. It's just an arising. And one way into that is what Cheryl's pointing to with this kind of really careful and curious investigation of, so what actually is here? And so the way that we convert pain into suffering is by trying to push away pain, by trying to push away what cannot be pushed away. And in our ordinary, not in zazen life, the pain and the pushing away of pain arise so quickly that we mistake them for the same thing. And so we mistake pain and suffering as the same thing. But in the experimental laboratory microscope of zazen, we start to see that there are those two different things. And so this allows us to work with seeing the aversion to pain. And if we desist from fueling the aversion to pain, pain becomes less of a problem. And if we can't desist from fueling the aversion to pain, we can desist from fueling the aversion to the aversion to pain. And if we can't do that, then the aversion to the aversion to the aversion to pain. And all of this is, this is why this container of stillness of zazen is utterly essential. And this is also why, whenever you're sitting zazen, it isn't the case that more is better and longer is better. So 5 minutes three times a week, 25 minutes three times a week, 10 minutes every day, doesn't actually matter. Some level of consistent engagement is essential, and then it's the practice of bringing it into the rest of your life. But regardless of how long you sit, always, always, always set a timer and sit for that long. Because otherwise, what you're doing is just sitting until you get jittery and the thought arises, oh my God, I can't take it anymore, and then you quit. And what that actually does is strengthen the karmic habit energy of reacting to, oh my God, I can't take it anymore. And part of what intensive practice, whether it's on a Saturday morning here, whether it's in our extended practice on an all-day sit, whether it's on a 3-day retreat whether it's on a commuter retreat, two long days in a row, part of what that does is lets us wear away at the conditioning of, oh my God, I can't take it anymore. And we see, I actually can. And that is very empowering.
So could I just quickly present an alternative way of meeting with pain in Zazen? So sometimes this works very well to do this turning towards and working with our pain and our reactions to it. But so I'm a person that has chronic pain, and when that flares up, I'm not necessarily able to work with pain in that way. If I turn my attention towards it, it just flares up and starts screaming at me louder and louder. But I find for me that there's a way of including the pain in this sitting with my entire mind and body and the whole universe in the presence of this pain without, you know, like directing my attention to it, but just allowing myself to be aware of it, that allows me to continue sitting without actually having the pain become the focus and flare up for me. So that's another way of dealing with that in some cases.
Or that's a better expressed version of the same way. And one image that's sometimes used for this is like if you imagine you have like a measuring cup full of salt and you put it into 8 ounces of water, that will be really unpleasant water to drink. But if you take that same amount of salt, which is pain, for instance, and pour it into a vast container of water, then that is, it can be borne, you can bear it differently. And this is the, coming back to what Julie pointed us to, this is the sitting is the bigger container. And this is Steve showing sitting a bigger container for pain. Thank you, everyone.